Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now then, as you can see, we're joined in studio by Jason Black. Jason, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
You've just said to me before we started, I do talk a lot, so interrupt me if I'm talking too much.
Absolutely.
It's perfect. It's what every interviewer wants to hear. It means I don't have to do very much work. How do I class you? Is it extreme endurance athlete?
No, I suppose I'm known as a global endurance athlete, which basically I take on endurance races globally. And they can be anything from mountains to rivers to long distance racing. I just enjoy sport, enjoy Mother Nature, enjoy the challenge of the battle.
Your headline achievement, looking in from afar, is you managed to climb and descend, because both are tough, K2. Is that your big achievement? Is that the one that people know you most for? That was last year.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I've been in this industry for a long number of years, you know, probably 25 years in total. And, you know, the headline really started with Everest in 2013. You know, people sat up and realized, wow. And then you become, you know, taken a little bit more serious. And then, I suppose, for me, as a mountaineer, a purist mountaineer growing up in Donegal here in Ireland, you know, for me, I just, K2 was always K2, and it was the Mountaineer's Mountain, and it was the one that was revered as the most fearsome mountain in the world. And I set course on that, and I was very privileged and honoured to summit and survive K2 last year.
It's not a normal way, I suppose, a conventional way to make your way through the world. So I'm curious as to how you arrived at this lifestyle choice, because you're a family man, you've four children, and these are dangerous pursuits, and they're difficult pursuits.
Yeah,
and
really difficult, yeah.
Require sacrifices. You said sport is your salvation.
Yeah, it really is my salvation. And, you know, I suppose, you know, people can put you on a pedestal and look about what you achieve, but behind it all, there's a journey, and behind it all, there's a huge commitment, and behind it all, there's a start line. And it started for me in Donegal as a young boy, starting out as a Cub Scout at 6 years of age. I was blessed to be introduced to the great outdoors by two wonderful leaders, and they introduced me to the mountains and the rivers and the lakes, and I just fell in love with Mother Nature, and it became a critical crutch for me later in life, because I had a very happy young life up until I went to secondary school in Letterkenny, and I fell to the hands of an extremely violent bully who over a period of 6 years destroyed my education. And it was a physical and mental battle every day to be at school, and I was from the countryside, and I was really struggling to process it. And I suppose Ireland back then was a very different world. You know, the support mechanisms to deal with, no doubt, a youthful depression is what I had at the hands of the bully. Even the effects of the bully and how to handle the bully weren't there. I chose not to tell my mum and dad, because I could see life at home was extremely difficult. They were working really hard to keep food on the table for four kids. And I walked out of that school at 17 with no junior cert and no leaving cert. And it's quite interesting, you know, the junior cert and the leaving cert started today. And I was just giving that a bit of thought coming down the road, you know, walking out of there in 1988 with no qualification to my name. The road to the left and to the right was extremely dark, and I was really tumbling through life. I didn't really have a direction. And the only thing that kept me sane, kept me grounded, was sport. When I turned around, the great outdoors, whether it was on the bicycle or in the mountains or in the rivers, it was the one environment that didn't judge me.
Yes.
And it just allowed Jason Black to be Jason Black. Because I felt judged every day at school by the bully because of how I looked and how I behaved. I felt judged by not getting results at school by the teachers, and
did any of the teachers say, Jason, you seem smart, you seem like you should be doing better than you are?
No, I think it was a different Ireland.
Is everything okay?
No, it was a different Ireland. You know, today I spend a huge amount of time back in the schools talking to young kids, particularly young boys, 15 to 17, and girls, about not being afraid of life and not being afraid of the challenges of life and setting goals and dreams. So I think, you know, I'm experiencing a different school today. When I'm in the schools, the teachers are incredible. They're young, they're creative, they're engaged. The students respect them. There's an open line of communication to the teachers and to the students today. That didn't exist in the 80s in Ireland. Sad as it was, you know, I missed an education, not because I was a stupid young fella. I lost the love for school. I just lost the love for being there.
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah.
We've all come across bullies at school.
Yeah.
Because they're in every walk of life.
Yeah.
When you say, you know, the way you acted, or like, what was it that this bully, clearly unhappy in his own life, in his own weird way, what was it that he was targeting you over?
I think it was because I was from the countryside. Growing up in Donegal, I was from a more rural part of Letterkenny, and he was from the town itself. He was more in tune with, and streetwise, I wasn't. Yeah. I was coming in green behind the ears.
He spotted that probably.
He spotted it, and I was vulnerable. You know, I'm a big guy, 6'2" today, and I'm well able to handle myself today, but when I was 13, I wasn't. I was a young, slow grower, and I was vulnerable. Mm. And, you know, it was a horrible time because my secondary school, my national school, we didn't have a uniform. And I was super excited about the next chapter in my life, the next journey, because I was getting a new uniform, new books, new bag. I was getting a school bus for the first time ever to school.
Yeah.
And it was this magical journey, you know, that was about to take place. And it was incredible that it all fell apart.
Do you kind of mourn that?
I did for a long number of years. Yeah. You know, there's no question that, you know, the scars of a bully can't be seen. You know, I would love to have had a black eye, a bruised arm. I would love to have, you know, a cut, and somebody could have asked the question, because I wasn't creative or courageous enough to say help. And it's probably my biggest regret, if I'm being very honest, you know, that I didn't have the courage to say stop or please help. I chose to suck it up. And, you know, that's what I say today to young people, and indeed to people in employment, to people in marriages, you know, because bullying's taken the form in incredible ways today. People's vulnerabilities with the homelessness, with the pressures of mortgages, you know, employers are putting them under extreme pressures, you know, and tenants, landlords are putting tenants under extreme pressures because they know they're exposed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was exposed, and I know what it feels like, and it's a very traumatic place to be.
Was it physical? Was it verbal mainly?
It was a bit of both.
And a kind of a constant thing during
every
the day.
Yeah. And you know, for me, like, it was at 9 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the evening, and I could escape it at four. And this is what I do talk about today with the online platforms that we have. The bully can exist 24/7.
Sure.
And it's horrendous, the online bully, you know, that keyboard warrior, the real card that can hide behind it and be so destructive.
I'm sure you could to a point, but equally, 7 o'clock in the evening, 8 o'clock in the evening, 9 o'clock, nearly bedtime, nearly back in it tomorrow. You never fully escaped it, I'm sure.
No, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning was the worst. The minute I opened my eyes, that 8 to 9 was horrendous. Eating my breakfast, you know, just picture eating the bowl of cornflakes and the hair standing on the back of your neck, not able to eat the food. You know, your mum's kind of quizzing what's going on. You're hiding it as best you can, knowing that when you walk through those gates, it's just going to start again. And
other kids laugh, other kids don't want it to be them, so they're happy enough to.
And we didn't, as a society, you know, I don't blame anybody. Like, I don't blame the school, I don't blame my parents, I blame the bully, but I don't blame the other parts of the jigsaw puzzle, because it was a different Ireland.
Sure.
You know, and we all weren't trained to deal with the effects of it. And but the scars were horrendous, you know. It got to the point where, you know, I'd lost complete faith in myself. Mm. I had no confidence in myself. And
because a friend of mine in his 50s recently was talking about being bullied at school. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And he said he can still feel it now in himself when something small might happen and he might feel like he's been, you know, personally jilted. It might be someone in a shop.
Absolutely,
you know, not giving chance. Just small little things. And he can almost feel he's more sensitive to it than other people.
Yeah,
it has shaped him.
Anybody that's been at the cutting edge of it will feel it, taste it, smell it. And it's a very deep-rooted experience. And even now that, you know, I've used the great outdoors to deal with it, to endure it, and to cleanse myself from it as best I can.
Mm-hmm.
There's still an element of it inside you, if I'm being completely honest, that you can't shake.
It's too formative, though. Those years are too formative.
Yeah, and the scars are too ingrained. And I suppose, you know, an opportunity like today, you know, to publicly speak about it is wonderful, because that's part of the therapy.
We've never talked about bullying on the show, really. Like, I do not get sports people in here talking about it. One, because quite often, I suspect, not always and not to generalise, but quite often the sports people were very admired in their school days.
Of course
it was
they were,
a
yeah.
great thing to be yeah. the best footballer.
And there's
in
a macho thing too.
And two, there was a real macho thing. It's yeah, a tough look, thing to come in and say I was bullied.
Yeah, and look, you know, even whenever I was growing up, you know, when people had asked me how are you, you know, the typical man response, this typical Irish man response was, yeah, I'm fine. And you sucked it up. But inside you weren't. Mm. And that's it. That was a clear reality for me. And like for a long number of years, Joe, I couldn't even have had this conversation with you. I couldn't have.
You felt ashamed?
No, I just hadn't the courage to speak about it. Okay. I just, you know, I didn't want to relive it again. And every time I spoke about it, I was reliving the event. Mm. And it was really and truly only whenever I got to the super big mountains that I got an opportunity to deal with it. And what that looked like was because when I was on a typical expedition that was maybe a week or two long, they were kind of a quick in, quick out job. So you were kind of very focused on the expedition. It was a high impact, high speed expedition. You were in, you were out. Or if it was a race, and there were so many other parts of the jigsaw puzzle that was taking up your time. Mm. But when you're on an expedition like say, Everest or any of the big 7,000, 8,000 meter mountains, you're on an expedition for 2 months. And you're so removed from this world that you have no choice but to listen to your mind. And what happens is, and this is really what happened to me, was that in this world, my life was so busy that I hadn't actually dealt with the effects of the bully.
Yeah.
I had moved on. There was another meeting to go to. There was another race to attend. There was another training session to get to. Later in life, there was a child come along. The time was set up. There was a mortgage to pay. There was X, Y, and Z to sure. do. But it was only when I got an opportunity to go to the big mountains and be away for so long and be removed from all the tools of this world, the internet, the online,
the distractions,
and then all of a sudden, Jason Black was screaming. And I mean, he was screaming. Like it was terrifying. Like I lost my mum when I was 17, shortly after the bully. And like my mum was the glue in her family, mm. like most Irish mums. I lost my brother at 25 in a motorbike accident. I was 25, he was 24. And I hadn't dealt with this. It was only, you know, when I got the opportunity like that, that my world was screaming, but I wasn't listening. Mm. And then all of a sudden, I'm climbing Everest and it re-emerged and I had to deal with the bully. And I mean, it was so raw, it was frightening. I had to deal with my mum's death. I had to deal with my brother's death. So I'm crying, I'm weeping, I'm mourning, I'm searching, I'm screaming. And at the same time, I'm trying to climb one of the greatest mountains of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I've come here to climb a mountain. I'm not here to climb that. But really and truly, and this is the crux of the jigsaw puzzle, I didn't realize it, but I was climbing out of the gutter of life when I was on those mountains. And when I stood on the summit of Mount Everest, first and foremost, in 2013, I wasn't standing on the top of the world. I was standing on the top of my world. Mm-hmm. I had survived the bully. I had survived my brother's death. I had survived my mum's death to cancer. And, you know, I had survived a youthful depression in Donegal. I had survived suicide.
Really?
Yeah. And I just felt the world would be a better place without Jason Black in it.
What age were you when you reached that conclusion?
Probably 21.
Right.
Quite lost. And again, never said it to anybody. And my saving grace was sport. It was the one thing that allowed me to scream louder than anything. Mm. It was the one thing that, you know, I could just get on the bike and ride it like I was out of control. I could get into the mountains and scream because nobody was listening. Mm. And Mother Nature became my best friend. I could just disappear for days. And people ask me today, why do I still continue to do what I do? Because the best version of Jason Black exists in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say that I don't enjoy the world the way I have it today. I do, I love it. I've created a great world for myself and my family. I love the world, I love the people I'm around. I share the world with extremely, extremely positive people, and I choose not to share it with negative people. And but it was a dark time. When I stood on the summit of that world, I had survived. And when I held that Irish flag above my head, it meant more to me than the summit of Mount Everest, you know, and then to go on to the big one, then K2, just, you know, and I was following in the footsteps of Jared MacDonald from Limerick. You know, Jared had got there in 2008.
Yeah.
And unfortunately never got down. And, you know, I got an opportunity to meet Jared's family, and I'd unconsciously been following Jared's footsteps as a mountaineer. His apprenticeship and my apprenticeship nearly matched each other with Alaska and Africa and all the different climbs he had taken on. I was, you know, 5 or 6 years behind him, and You know, when I stood there that day, the pride that I felt on the summit of K2 was incredible, you know, just knowing that he had got there and I was there. And then the fear hit me, you know, the fear of, I'm only halfway there, I've got to get off this thing, you know.
If we take it in bite-sized chunks, Everest in 2013, where on the one hand you're dealing with the fallout from your childhood and your mother's death and your brother's death, and then you're trying to also deal with the physical demands of trying to climb Everest.
Yeah.
8,000 plus meters, temperatures minus 30 degrees, which we can discount, you know, we think, well, you've got your gear, it can't be that cold.
Yeah.
But I saw you even say the inside of your nose and your gums can go to pieces.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to climb Everest? How difficult did you suspect it would be, and what was the reality?
It was really hard. I chose to do the north side of Mount Everest, so I went through Tibet and China and up through the Rumbuk side, so really challenging side. I chose deliberately to do that. I'd been training on the south side for several years leading up to the climb, and I had witnessed the kind of the prostitution that was going on the southern side of the mountain with the discarding of waste, with the commercialization that was growing at the time.
Mm.
And unfortunately, we witnessed it very sadly over the last few weeks. But I decided that as a purist climber and as a skilled mountaineer, that if I was going to be climbed, it would have to be on the northern side, where in essence the safety net was removed. It was just me, my ability, my skill level to survive the mountain.
Mm.
And that meant a lot to me, because I'd kind of spent most of my life like that. I had to rely on Jason Black to survive, and if I was going to take on Mount Everest, it was going to be on those terms.
Yeah. When you talk about what's going on the Nepalese side, I think we've all seen the photographs in recent weeks, and it does look like a long queue for some kind of tourist attraction.
Yeah, there have
been 11 deaths in May, and two of them Irishmen, which is really awful, and not what Everest, even from a mythical point of view, is meant to represent.
Yeah, it's a really relevant point, Joe. You know, it's very, very sad to see what's happened at the minute. Four large Nepalese companies have just become commercial giants there and have turned it into a commercial cash cow. And unfortunately, they purchased 391 permits this year from the Nepalese government and chose to sell them to unvetted mountaineers. A large majority of them are good, strong, committed mountaineers. You know, the sad thing about it is in like 2016, the mountain was being guided by 80% Westerners who generally were extremely experienced mountaineers who would have had a very finely tuned vetting process, and you would have had small teams hand-picked, hand-selected with a good chance of success. And this year was a prime example where you had 20% guided by Western climbers and 80% by Nepalese climbers. When you put 391 permits purchased and you put one Sherpa per climber, that means you had nearly just short of 800 people pushing for the summit inside 40 hours. In a track above 8,000 metres, that's just the width of your boots, you could see that people were queued for 18 hours. Oxygen levels last for about 14. It's assisted oxygen. I know from talking to some of my climbing friends, a lot of people ran out of oxygen. Sherpas had to give up their oxygen. And it was a disaster. And It was horrible to witness it, that mountaineering was brought into the gutter over the head of greed, first and foremost, and egotistic. There was people on that mountain that shouldn't have been on that mountain, because they were driven to the fact that they want to be able to beat their chest and say that they climb Mount Everest, and were doing it for all the wrong reasons.
Mm. Mm. There is almost like it's a CEO excursion, so they can put it on their LinkedIn.
It's terrible.
To the whole thing. You do have that suspicion with
someone. Yeah, and that's a reality, and let's not avoid the elephant in the room. That's the truth. And there's that trophy that people perceive it to be.
Mm.
It's certainly not a trophy. You know, Everest only gives you the permission to survive it. You don't summit it. You don't conquer it. I've heard the word conquer being used. You never conquer any of these things. You're given permission to survive. And that's it. And if you choose to dance with that devil too many times, it will catch you.
You have to respect it. Yeah.
Very much so.
Fast forward to last year and K2. K2 is about 150 metres shorter than Everest.
Yeah.
But 20% steeper.
Start steep, finish steep.
Mm. To put it in context, if we're talking about the numbers now climbing Everest, so since Edmund Hillary went up, 4,833 people, give or take, I got this last stat, 4,830-odd people have summited Everest.
Yeah.
Fewer than 400 have gone up K2 since 1954?
340 people have summited at K2.
Okay, this is a different beast.
Well, you know, if you put that in context, you know, the global community of mountaineers that exist in the world, only 340 have ever got up.
Mm.
And many has tried. And it's just a different animal. I tried it in 2015. I got hit with an avalanche above Camp 3, took out all my gear, my oxygen, stove, gas, everything was gone.
Yeah.
Expedition was over, had to turn around, walk away. And I treated it like a stone in my shoe. You know, even since 2015, I had this stone in my shoe feeling, you know, will I ever have the opportunity to return? Will I have ever the permission to return from my family? Mm-hmm. You know, it's something I take very serious. Will I ever have the confidence, the wherewithal, financially and physically and mentally to go back in again? Because what people don't realize that not only are you on expedition, everybody's on expedition, your family, your community, and it's a big commitment. And there is that sense of cutting that umbilical cord in life when you step into that arena.
Because again, I mean, and this may, you know, there's a fatality rate of 25%, give or take.
1 in 3, yeah.
Yes. Who go up K2? 4 kids, you got a wife, you got many achievements already.
Yeah.
And so does any part of you spend time with yourself and ask, well, Jason, these are the risks. This is what you're potentially going to put your family through. Maybe I just haven't reached a point, given everything we've just talked about in the past, where I just can't, like, why can't I be just happy in myself here?
Yeah.
When is enough going to be enough for me to not do this? Did you have those kind of conversations?
Yeah, look, you know, I live in the real world. You know, there's no question, and I'll admit it, and I admit it publicly, you know, mountaineers that climb 8,000 meter mountains on a regular basis tend to be very selfish because it's an exposure.
Mm.
You know, and as I said earlier, if you dance with the devil enough times, the devil will beat you. I have to be content with what I've achieved to date on as far as 8,000 meter mountains. The two biggest in the world are bagged for me. I suppose for me, you know, if I'm very honest, I did take the measured steps to stay as safe as I could. And what that looks like is I'd spent 25 years training for it.
Mm.
You know, my preparation was meticulous, you know, physically and mentally. I climbed with an exceptional team that was developed over 2 years, 10 of the best mountaineers in the world, and to make that team for me was just incredible.
Mm.
So I knew the team I was with had serious substance. And I've always believed in life that if we can control what we can control, there's elements of life that we can't control. Like, I'm just about to start a race over the next few days, 2,500 kilometres around the coastline of Ireland, and God willing, I'll safely get around it, but there could be a situation that I might not. It's not that I recklessly do what I do. I suppose what I call more reckless is people that tend to do what they do and not prepare for it. But I genuinely take measured steps to make sure I come home. And I have a promise with my wife, Sharon, who's 50% the success of what I do, because if I didn't have that support at home, it would be useless.
Yeah.
And we've both made a promise to each other that if I ever get to a point that it's not making sense. So if I get to a point in the mountain that it's not making sense, the weather's broken down, my health is broken down, the expedition's just not working, well then you have to turn around. You know, the mountain's going nowhere, I can come back, I'll have another opportunity to come back. And to answer your question bluntly, all I can ever do is take the measured steps that I can control what I can control. I can't control outside of that. Was I ever in harm's way? Of course I was.
How long does it take to go up K2?
It took me 2.5 months.
2.5 months.
Yeah.
Did all 10 make it up?
Yeah, 8 of us got up. 2 didn't. One got sick halfway up. A Polish girl, fabulous climber, just got a GI issue in her stomach. And Dan, one of the most tragic situations was that Dan was sitting eating a butterscotch sweet in Camp 4 and broke the side of his tooth as we were just getting ready to push to the summit. And the poor guy had spent nearly two months on the mountain preparing. And because he exposed his nerve, he had no choice but to drop down. And can you imagine what that feels like? So a simple butterscotch sweet, he was sitting eating it, broke the side of his tooth, exposed the nerve, minus 30 degrees, game over, had to drop down.
That's hard to digest.
Yeah, look, very tough, and poor Dan, you know, it's just heartbreaking, you know. And But it was incredible. And even at Camp 4, you don't know, is it on? You don't know, is it possible? You know, there was a Japanese team that decided to go with us on the day. They weren't meant to go. and they weren't actually climbing with any Sherpa. They lost a climber. I witnessed that. Japanese climber, another girl in the same team, washed out all her oxygen. I got her at 8,200 meters, completely just about to unclip from the rope because she had lost all the oxygen, and she had lost conscious decision as to where she was. And I got her oxygen from the shoulder at 8,400 meters and saved her life. And
what's the protocol there? Are you meant to stop and help
people? I suppose this is the reality. I suppose, you know, when Jeremy Donald decided to stop in 2008, when the rest of his team decided to descend and they survived and he didn't. But I suppose his human instinct was to stop. I suppose as an Irishman, it's very much built into us. And for me, when it was happening for me with the Japanese girl, it was like, oh my God, this is like deja vu for Jeremy Donald. And but I have it all recorded on GoPro, and I watched it just there not too long ago for the first time, and it was harrowing to watch somebody that exposed herself at 8,200 meters and was about to unclip and all ended all because she didn't consciously know where she was. Whenever, you know, when people, what people don't understand is whenever you remove the amount of oxygen that's available from in the atmosphere from your body, I recorded 14% oxygen, you know, and if you're 93% here at ground level, they put you on life support machine.
And what's the most difficult thing? Well, look, that's plenty, what you just described, but over the 2 months, is it, does fatigue kick in? Are you sleeping well? In terms of eating, is your digestive system working? Like, what's the main reason people have to say, I got to turn back?
Yeah, I suppose, like, that's a really good point. Whenever you take away oxygen and the pressure changes up there, the weather's really hard and harsh, all the comforts are gone. The heat's gone, the light switch is gone, the kettle is gone, the typical things we take for granted are gone. The lack of oxygen being the big one, the lack of sleep, because you just can't sleep as deep as you would here normally. You're not eating as well as you'd like to eat, and you're not getting the same calorie intake, because like we took up 2 cows, 1 buffalo, 14 goats, 60 hens live, and killed them at base camp as we needed them. So we had an element of protein available to us, but not high quality. We had an element of carbohydrate, but not high quality. So you're not getting the same nutrients. Even as an athlete, people will understand this. You know, a normal fit athlete can heart rate, it's, you know, 60 beats per minute. Up there, I was sitting at 130 beats per minute just at rest.
Resting.
So, you know, you have this engine that's turned up. So when you go to sleep at night, if you're sitting with a heart rate of 130 beats per minute, you nearly hear your heart in your chest. Okay, climatization does happen over several weeks and months, but it's never what's experienced down here at this level. And then the higher up you go, the more demanding it is in the body. The digestive system is definitely shutting down. The vital organs are getting supplied with whatever oxygen's available in the air. Certainly above camp 4, you're down to the bare essentials. And then when you enter the death zone, we're never designed to be there. So it's a ticking time bomb. And that's where the apprenticeship as a mountaineer is so critical. And when we go back to what we witnessed on Mount Everest this year with people that shouldn't be there, whenever this starts to happen, you realize and recognize the symptoms that this is quite normal as a high altitude mountaineer. You don't panic, you don't get into a frenzy, and you actually are comfortable with what's happening, as extreme as they are. But whenever you're just decide to climb an 8,000 meter mountain with limited experience, and all of a sudden this happens, it sends you tumbling, and then you start to lose the faculty of survival, and then we witness falls and people getting high altitude sickness and the trouble that happened.
You talked about 2013 and Everest as almost a cathartic experience in many ways, and maybe you gave what was going on deep inside a chance to almost come out in the calmness of it. The feelings when you're climbing K2, have you processed a lot of what you talked about in 2013? Is it a different experience? Is it just about the climb for you then?
Yeah, I probably could enjoy the climb better than 2013. You know, 13 was a very much a cleansing process, was
harrowing in some ways.
Coming to grips with it. You know, there was so much emotion going on, fear, anxiety, you know, anger, frustration, excitement. I'm on Everest. So it was a bag of dolly mixtures. And I walked away from it very humble and gratified that I had accomplished more than climbing Mount Everest, that sure. I had the courage to deal with the elephant in the room. And that allowed me then to really enjoy K2.
For what it was, almost.
Yeah, really for what it was, and to really enjoy the fact that I was on the mountain and I wasn't nervous. I was in harmony with the mountain. I was absolutely able to climb it. I wasn't struggling at any point, even above the super high sections, you know, the bottleneck, the traverse around the Serac, you know, House Chimney, Black Pyramid, all these really super, super aggressive parts of the mountain. I was at home. I was completely comfortable. There wasn't a nervous bone in my body because I knew I had the work done.
Mm.
And
almost in a state of flow in the moment,
yeah,
as you negotiated each part of it.
Totally. I was really comfortable. I was flowing beautifully on the mountain on the way up. I fell apart slightly on the way down because I suppose the fear of getting back down again, knowing that Jared didn't survive, it hit me home a wee bit.
Yeah.
Then I had to sit down and kind of talk to myself again and just galvanize. Look, Jason, it's okay. You've been here before. You've survived it, as in life. You've trained for this. You have the skill set to survive it. And then the confidence came back in again. And that was incredible, you know. And, you know, then, you know, I honored Jerry MacDonald on behalf of the Irish people by putting a plaque permanently at base camp just to mark his heroic actions in 2008.
And getting to the summit is phenomenal achievement as well.
Phenomenal. And not only just his heroic actions to summit, but his heroic actions to put other lives before his own.
Mm.
And to some people would say, God, it's not the done thing. But I suppose having met Gertie and met Jer's family, his sisters, and JJ, his brother, and Damien, his brother-in-law, and just getting an understanding of the type of character that Jared MacDonald was, I know now why he stopped. He wasn't that selfish, egotistic human being. He was very much a self-centered, a very loving and caring human being. And if Jared MacDonald had walked past that Korean team, he would have died anyway at home, because I don't believe that his conscience would have been in the right place.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to do at the time, I would imagine, and then doubly tough to live with yourself
afterwards.
For years afterwards, yeah. Having done K2 and Everest, are there other mountains that you're going after, or will your life as an endurance athlete, as a global endurance athlete, mean more races like the ones you're doing around Ireland? Or, you know, is this something you're going to do into your 70s?
Yeah, look, you know, to answer the question bluntly, I want to finish the 7 summits, you know, the highest mountain in each continent. I have 2 left to do, and both of them are easy in complete terms of what I've achieved mountaineering-wise. I'd love to finish the last one with my wife. It's not a difficult climb. And, you know, from the rest of my sporting world, I'm enjoying the fact that I'm able to... I suppose what I've learned through the battles of life is that I've learned to condition my mind really well, and I'm able to endure a lot. And I'm not only just from a physical perspective, I'm able to put myself in a tough place. I'm able to put my mind in a tough place and survive, and I enjoy that. And as mad as that sounds, that's where I get my biggest kick.
Right.
And today I'm heavily involved in endurance racing, super long, whether it's race across America, race around Ireland, race across Italy, or I was racing across Southeast Asia last week in Laos. And, you know, I've developed an incredible, I've been blessed to have been given an incredible gift to do what I do. And, you know, when I can do what I do at 48 years of age and be competitive, I want to do it. And more importantly, I think actions speak louder than words in a classroom. And for me, that's really important, because I think when you read something in a book, it's words, but when you stand in front of somebody and you can look at them in the white of the eye and they can tell you a real human story that they've climbed out of the gutter of life, and that today they're unstoppable, and that life has a glass ceiling, and that we all should have dreams, goals and aspirations. And do they come easy? No. They come at the hands of hard work, dedication, commitment, focus and drive. But with that commitment, focus and drive, you can achieve anything in this world. And when you're telling that to a young 15-year-old boy in Ireland or in England or Scotland or Wales, and I was in Oman there in February and had 2,000 kids, and a kid's a kid.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether it's in Ireland or in Thailand or somewhere in the world, they still have the same goals and same dreams and same aspirations. And, you know, and I have this feeling and responsibility through my good, bad and ugly side of my experience of life to share and to make a difference, because I believe that the greatest gift we have as human beings is to be able to make a difference in somebody else's life. And for me, I just want to share. I want to share my story. I want to share that it at a time it was dark, suicidal, depressed, and meaningless. And today it has purpose. Mm. It has a life. It has a color. It has a smell. It has a taste. And it has commitment. And inspiration's a word that doesn't sit very well with me, Joe, but I like to empower people not to be afraid. And also I think that, you know, we should just celebrate each other's successes, whatever that is, and we should never measure each other on each other's success, because yeah. I've experienced through my talks and through my interaction with communities globally that people are challenged daily with depression, disability, suicide, poverty. I've seen a lot of poverty. I've seen a lot of hardship. And while I only have to endure what I endure on a mountain for maybe 2 months or in a race for 2 weeks, these people have to endure it every day.
And when you're going through the 2 months, say in K2, or you're away for a period of time, and there's a real simplicity about your life, yeah. It's really just stay warm, get some food, turn off the light.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah. Is there something very appealing about that? How does the modern world feel in comparison?
It is two worlds. You step back into a very aggressive, very hungry, very busy world, very modern world, very connected world. It's the reality of life. You know, for the first while you come back, you're a bit sixes and sevens, as in, you know, people are sometimes unthankful for what they have. Because what I witness a lot, Joe, is that sometimes I see people in communities like Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, Nepal, Pakistan. They have nothing, but they have everything. And when I come home, we have everything. And at times, I think we have nothing. So it galvanizes for the fact for me that I have everything. I've got my health. I've got great friends. I've got the clothes that's on my back. I've got a few pounds in my pocket. And I've got a health and a wealth to enjoy life.
Because a lot of us understand that on a theoretical level, but I don't know if we feel it. I don't know if I feel it sometimes, you know. You need reminders.
Well, I think it's, you know, the greatest education and the greatest university is to travel, and you know, it's what I encourage young people to do, young and old, is to get out there and experience the world. And it's not to go to the Spains and the France. Go further, go into the impoverished parts of the world, really experience the world. You'll come back a stronger person. You'll come back very mindful of the world, and indeed you'll actually come back changed. And you'll come back with purpose, because you'll give your own life clear purpose. A day, every day should be valued. And I don't mean that kind of in a very spiritual way.
Yeah.
I genuinely mean that, you know, every day should be cherished. And, you know, I've heard my father, my grandfather, like yours, saying that, you know, life is very short and it's not a dress rehearsal, it's a once off. And if that is the case and we only have the chance to drink from this cup of life once, then let's drink from it wisely. And that's what I want for the rest of my life. You know, where does it all end? The question you asked. I don't see a finish line. You know, it's a bit like, you know, I'm going to start this race at Trinity College. It's 2,500 to the finish line. I can't see the finish line, but I know it's there. And that if I have the courage to continue to turn the pedals, one pedal stroke at a time, I'll get to the finish line. It's the same with the mountains. You know, when I'm at the base camp of K2 Everest or any big mountain, I generally can't see the summit. I have to have the confidence that it's there, and that if I keep moving forward, I'll get there. And life's like that. You know, I say to young kids that are sitting into the junior cert, leaving cert at the minute, or, you know, going for an interview, or worried about a relationship, or worried about life. It's just, you can't see the finish line of life, but have the courage to believe in yourself. Because I think that's the greatest strength we have, is self-belief. It's not really about the yardstick of your education, your bank balance, the car you drive, the clothes you wear. It's about you, yourself, and having the confidence to believe in you. And with that confidence, if you're prepared to keep moving forward, even though you can't see where it's going, you'll get there. And when you get there, it's incredible. And it's personal. And that level of success should be your level of success.
Mm.
It's not K2, it's not Everest. And I don't think I'm better than anybody else because of what I've achieved. I'm just Jason Black. I'm just this very ordinary person that was brought up in Letterkenny with two extraordinary parents in a very small rural community that chose to live an extraordinary life. but it didn't come without its scars.
Listen, we could talk all day. It's been a real pleasure. It's not every day we have people in talking about this range of subject matter, so it's been great for me as well. Jason Black, very best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.